Construction Association, please.
Mr. James L. Chick Jr. will be presenting argument for his petition.
Thank you, may it please the court. This is an employment covenant not to compete case. I represent the petitioner, who in the trial court was the defendant and was the employee who was subject to the covenant not to compete. As is spelled out in the Court of Appeals opinion and in our briefs, there is not a great deal of dispute about the facts, and except to the extent necessary for a particular argument, I will not spend a great deal of time in recanting the facts. Obviously, my argument is going to focus on this court's January 1987 opinion in the Joel Hill versus Mobile Auto Trim case. And before I launch into that, I'd like to make a comment about that. In this particular case that we're presenting to you, I think that there is basis for an agreement on this case among both the majority opinion and the dissent. I think that the fallacies of this particular covenant not to compete breach the difference that is evidenced in the majority and dissenting opinions in Joel Hill, and I'll get into that as I proceed. We think in examining all four of the factors or considerations to be taken into account in determining the enforceability of a covenant not to compete as spelled out in Joel Hill, that this one is flawed and is to be voided. Now, what I'd like to do would be to take up those factors, not necessarily in the order that they're discussed in Joel Hill, but instead in what I think is the obviousness of the error committed below. In Joel Hill, this court said that a covenant not to compete had to be buttressed by valuable consideration. And I read that to mean something other than the peppercorn that we were taught about in law school, that there must be something actually valuable given to the employee at the time he's required to sign the covenant. In this case, I think that valuable consideration was lacking. The facts are that after 3 years of employment with the plaintiff, Mr. Martin was handed a comprehensive covenant not to compete, which virtually took him out of the industry if enforced in toto, and he was required to sign it or be fired. All that he got, and it's spelled out in the literal language of the covenant itself, was the continuation of his job at the terms and conditions that were existent at that time. I don't believe that is the kind of valuable consideration that will support a covenant of this kind. The Joel Hill and the other cases talk about consideration in the context of, did the employee in a contract of employment get more than what he gave just for the contract of employment itself? The answer here is plainly no for several reasons. First of all, there is no comprehensive contract of employment in this case. All this is an agreement that you won't compete when you leave, in return for which you get to keep your job. Again, I don't think, and I don't think the dissent thought in Joel Hill that the majority was indicating that that was the kind of valuable consideration that would permit this kind of a restriction on an individual. Now, in Joel Hill and the other cases, both the majority and the dissent concluded that where an employee received consideration of the kind of special training or skills in return for which he signed the covenant, that would support a covenant not to compete. In this particular case, that does not exist. Mr. Martin had been an employee for 3 years at the time he signed the covenant. Whatever skills and training he had accumulated pre-existed the signing of the covenant. There was no contemporaneous consideration given by way of special skills and training. Furthermore, Mr. Martin had been in the industry and was familiar with the industry for some 20 years before this time. So any argument that in return for the covenant not to compete he received contemporaneous special skills or training is simply wrong.
In the sequence of events, which came first, his becoming vice president or his signing the covenant not to compete?
He had been vice president of marketing for almost a year at the time he signed the covenant. Yes, ma'am. Now, what is the effect? And I think that this is somewhat unclear in Joel Hill, but I think it needs to be examined. What is the effect of lack of consideration vis-a-vis modification or reformation of the covenant not to compete? I think the answer is, if there's no consideration, the covenant is void. There is no modification of it. There simply is no consideration to support it, and it's gone. It's void. And I think that's what the majority was trying to do in Joel Hill. Now, the second aspect of Joel Hill that I think comes into play here is that there are two interests which a covenant not to compete can be used to support, one of which is protection of trade secrets. We have a specific finding of fact here that there were no trade secrets. It's not an issue. The second is the entitlement of an employer to protect his business goodwill. And in looking at this, I think you have to look at the fact record that was made in this case, and I think if you'll examine the statement of facts, you will find that the word goodwill was never used once in evidence in this trial. There is no evidence that the defendant even had goodwill. There's no evidence that Martin, when he left, played upon or was capable of playing upon or taking the employer's goodwill to his advantage. There's simply no demonstration in this factual record that Mr. Martin, by leaving and competing, misused the employer's business goodwill. Now, in a switch that I'm not completely able to explain to you, the district court entered its injunction based upon its finding that the covenant not to compete was founded in protection of customer information, that is, information about these 1,200 accounts which my client was precluded from soliciting. The Court of Appeals, when it wrote, avoided discussing that issue and our point there that this court said there were two other issues you could focus on, and simply made an unexplained leap to concluding that there were two other interests that were existent in this case and which could be protected. The first was the right of the employer to protect against my client's ability to divert the plaintiff's business to himself. The second, and they don't really tell us which is which or how they get from one to the other, but they go on to somehow say that there's another, or maybe it's an identical interest, in customer contacts, in precluding Mr. Martin from using those intimate customer contacts that he had developed while working for the plaintiff. Now, regardless, neither of those interests spelled out in the Court of Appeals opinion is business goodwill. And by that, I mean Mr. Martin's ability to divert business may, depending upon a fact record, consist of elements of personal goodwill, which this court has said you cannot be restricted, and or it could include business goodwill or any number of other factors. But there's no basis in logic or the law to say that business goodwill is necessarily the same thing as avoiding customer contacts or protecting them against his ability to divert business.
Well, I understand that all the customers consisted of cable TV companies.
Yes, throughout the United States. In this particular business, it's really not done on a geographical basis. You serve everyone throughout the United States that will avail themselves of your services.
But there is no secret as to the existence of what cable company and where it can be located, thank you.
No, in fact, the undisputed record evidence is that there's a book about 2 or 3 inches thick which lists every cable system throughout the United States, its address, the person responsible for operating the system, and other people to contact if you want to do business with them. It's public information created and distributed by the industry. Not only does focusing on my client's ability to divert business violate the notion that you can't restrict personal goodwill, it also, I think, runs contrary to the notion in Joel Hill that you can't preclude an individual from his common calling simply because he's able to practice that common calling well. And the Court of Appeals, by focusing on Mr. Martin's ability to divert business, I think avoided the real issue, and that is, was business goodwill existent? Did he have the ability to manipulate it, and did he in fact manipulate it when he left? Now, the second interest that the Court of Appeals focused on in its opinion, after making its leap from one interest to another, was customer contact. And if in fact under Joel Hill there's some equation between customer contact and business goodwill, then I'm going to argue it in that context with that assumption, although I don't think that there's necessarily an equation of protection against customer contact and intimacy or a salesman's relationship and business goodwill. Again, because part of that would inherently be Mr. Martin's personal goodwill and his ability to do business well based on his own personality traits and expertise. But assuming that that is something of a species of business goodwill, the pre-existent cases, those before Joel Hill, said you've got to focus on those customers that he had this special relationship with, that he had this contact with, so that he, in effect, became his employer, and therefore he could manipulate. The injunction in this case ran not just to those with which he had that kind of a relationship. It ran to those he sold at one time or another, visited, solicited, or even learned of directly or through his subordinates. Now, there's no case law or logic to preclude you from contacting people that you just learned of. More importantly, there's an evidentiary lacking in this case in two respects. First of all, there is no evidence presented by the plaintiff to distinguish between which of those 1,200 accounts he learned of, he solicited, he sold, or he visited. And that is a fatal flaw in our view. It also precludes remanding this case because an injunction which ran to the legitimate elements of a special salesman's relationship would be meaningless based on this fact record. You cannot go back based on this fact record and pick out which of the 1,200 Mr. Martin enjoyed this special relationship, if any, because there is no record evidence, and this is the second flaw, that he enjoyed a special relationship with any of the 1,200. And that was the plaintiff's responsibility at trial to establish those facts, and it did not do so. Now, this is the point at which I think there is basis to breach the difference as to result between the dissent in Joel Hill and the majority. That is, the dissent of this court in Joel Hill recognized that customer contact was a legitimate interest which could be protected, but it had to run to those accounts with which a salesman was intimate or could control. In this case, there is not a fact record to justify even imposition of what the dissent in Joel Hill thought was a legitimate basis for imposition of the covenant.
So you said 1,200 customers out of this book, about how many potential customers were there?
The defendant at one time, or the plaintiff at one time or another, the evidence would indicate, serviced 3,000 accounts from time to time. They indicated by checking on this list of 3,000 those customers which it contended it was serving at that time, and it resulted in about 1,200. Now,
that's what they wanted him to enjoin.
They wanted to enjoin him from all of those 1,200.
Plus all the other ones in your directory of tables.
Would be available to him.
Yeah.
But
so
again,
it's really a pretty narrow limitation.
No. It would seem to be that the record discloses that those 1,200 constitute, I don't remember the percentages, well over 50% of the customer service throughout the United States. The plaintiff here is the largest collection business in the cable television industry. It enjoys the best customers, and it enjoys over half, as I recall it, of the total market. Now, there's nothing surprising about that, given the fact that each little community has its own cable system. And a cable system, obviously, if you've got Austin, you've got a very good client. If you've got a very small town, they would look the same in looking at 1,200 out of 3,000, but there's a world of difference. And that brings me to another point that I want to make, after the, which I think glaringly shows how anti-competitive this covenant was. By the time we got to trial, some 6 or 7 months after the temporary injunction was issued, of the 1,200 accounts, the plaintiff was still servicing only 660 for reasons unrelated to my client being in the market. We asked the judge, does your injunction preclude us from contacting those other 540 which have left the plaintiff because of the competitiveness of the market? The judge said, no, you cannot go after them. They were among the 1,200 when this started, and you can't go get them now. Now, what interest is served by that? There's only one interest served by an injunction that's that broad, and that's plainly anti-competitive. When someone leaves CPA and goes off and is serviced by someone else, how is CPA's interest protected? Is legitimate business goodwill protected by keeping my client from going and soliciting them? That standing alone is an overly broad injunction, but I think it's indicative of what's wrong with this situation generally. Two other things I want to touch on. The Frankowitz case, which is discussed in the brief, says that there have got to be geographical restrictions for a covenant not to be enforceable. There are none in this case. It went instead to the nationwide market and 1,200 of those accounts nationwide. And we think it's void on that basis. Also, the three-year restriction, the covenant itself had a three-year restriction as literally written. But there's no evidence, and the burden was on the plaintiff to come forward with evidence to support the reasonableness of 3 years. In this case, the president of the plaintiff didn't even testify he thought to protect his business goodwill or whatever he thought he was protecting. He needed a year, he needed 2 years, he needed 3 years. And certainly there's got to be, the restrictions are matters of law, but there, and the reasonableness of them is, but still there's got to be some record evidence to support what the district court did in exercising its discretion to enter this injunction.
Counsel, let me ask you a question there. I don't recall in Hill versus Mobile Auto Trim where we placed the burden of proof. Did we place it on the employer who seeks to knock out the restrictive covenant, or do we seek it on the employer who seeks to sustain it?
It's my recollection that the burden of proof as to the reasonableness of the restrictions is on the employer. Now, consideration, I don't think there's a specific discussion in that regard.
But he has to prove it's reasonable, even though he's not the plaintiff?
I think so. He's the one that's seeking to impose the restriction. It's a restriction which is against
him. He's got the contract, which is kind of prima facie, that he's entitled to the injunction. It would seem like it would be the defendant's burden, the employee's burden, to show that it was unreasonable. I'm just asking, I'm not sure what Mobile Home says.
Well, first of all, beginning before the Hill case, and the Martin versus, I forgot the name of the women's service, that case, which is NRE, says specifically the burden is on the employer to establish the reasonableness of the covenants. I think the context of Joel Hill plainly places the burden there if it doesn't directly. And while counsel is speaking, I'm going to try to find some language in the decision which would address that if there is any. But the point being that you start out from the proposition in these cases that covenants not to compete are against the public policy of this state. The burden rests then on the person who wants to impose it to establish that it's reasonable, that there's a basis for somehow getting around what is the very broad public policy against these kinds of covenants. And I think that's a burden that's well placed. Irrespective of that, I think we've established that there was no valuable consideration, regardless of who had the burden. If I had the burden, I think I plainly met it. Now, on a broader scale, I think that there is a fallacy in the way that these cases proceed. This is the only area of the law that I've been able to find where the court takes the party's agreement and instead of affirming it or rejecting it, becomes a super businessman and decides what was best for the employer and the employee based upon the existing facts. And what's the effect of that? Just as in this case, the employer can walk in with a covenant not to compete that is so restrictive that it literally takes him, if enforced, out of the industry. He begins weighing his options as to what he's going to do, and he reads it, and he's going to be completely intimidated by that restrictive covenant. If, in fact, he decides to leave and compete, then the employer gets a second bite at the apple. He had it when he wrote the covenant, and now he gets a second bite at the apple, asking the judge to enforce it only to the extent that it's reasonable. This imposes a great burden on the employee, as in this case. To find out what his rights are, he's got to spend his own attorney's fees. In this case, he's got to bear his company's attorney's fees, only to find out that as written, the covenant was unenforceable, but now the court's going to tell you what you should have done in the first place. Now, the personnel files of companies in this state are full of covenants not to compete, just like the one, the broad one that you have here. If we're ever to get to a point where employers are going to look at the real facts and tailor their covenants not to compete to their legitimate interests, tailor them to the functions that the employee was performing, they're going to have to write them in the first instance to be enforceable. If not, you're going to have intimidating covenants not to compete like the one in this case, which on their face are unenforceable, but put the burden on the employee to go find out what his covenant really means and the extent to which it's enforceable. I would ask you to consider the imposing on the employer the burden of writing a covenant not to compete, which is enforceable. If it's not, it's void. It's unreasonable, in my view, for a sophisticated businessman to write a covenant not to compete, impose it on his employee, find out that it's unreasonable, and then a court that knows nothing about the industry, nothing about the business, write it for them. No other area of the law is that done. And especially in the context as here, where you're dealing in an area that's not favored by public policy, this is anti-competitive. Why that advantage? Why do we make that exception here in an area that isn't one that's favored by the law? I don't understand it, and I would ask you to re-examine that. If that's done and employers have that responsibility, then we can get away from these extended trials, this business of the courts writing for us what the employer should have written in the first place, and put the responsibility where it really belongs. Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you, Ken. We will now hear argument from respondent.
Mr. Robert A. Miller will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court. The issue before you today is whether Bruce Martin's post-employment covenant not to compete is enforceable. Your answer to that question, however, will probably determine whether or not there are any post-employment covenants not to compete that can become enforceable in the state of Texas. Now, why do I say that? Put it in such bold and stark terms. I say that because in this case, we have a person who had no prior experience in debt collection, was trained by a CPA in debt collection, became the vice president in charge of sales for the entire company, and it is a national company, supervised employees throughout the United States, sold himself throughout the United States, went to trade shows and conventions not to represent Bruce Martin, but to represent the Credit Protection Association, had direct contact with all the customers throughout his employment, was a highly paid executive, and in fact became known as Mr. CPA. People mistook him for the owner of the business instead of the true owner. If CPA cannot protect an employee of this stature from competing against it the day after he leaves, and that's essentially what happened here, and taking their best customers, their most profitable customers from them, then no covenant not to compete will be valid in Texas. The factors that I've just enumerated show that Bruce Martin received valuable consideration in this case. As this court noted in Hill versus Mobile Auto Trim, the special training or knowledge acquired by the employee through his employer is valuable consideration and often enhances the value of the employee to other firms. To allow employees to use or sell this valuable training or knowledge upon leaving a firm would create a disincentive for employers to train or educate employees.
Did he get all that training before he signed this agreement or after?
He got it, most of it probably before, and Mr. Hicks indicated that nowhere in the record does anybody say anything about goodwill. But you got to remember, this company was not organized until 1977. Mr. Martin was not hired until 1980. In 1983, Mr. Levine testified at the temporary injunction hearing that they decided that they spent a lot of money on the customers, and I want to quote this. He said, "We, being Mr. Martin and myself, and Mr. Adenalo, who was one of our key salesmen, determined that our business was growing to the point where it would probably be necessary and proper for us to protect some of the confidentiality of our business and some of the techniques, and the fact that we are expending so much money calling on clients, developing goodwill for credit protection, we determined that it was now necessary to have our people, especially our key people, sign some agreements of this type to protect us in the event they were to leave our company. We would have our customers protected." And that's on page 77 of the temporary injunction statement of facts. But if he had signed the agreement right when he started to work, Mr. Hicks would be up here saying he didn't receive any consideration when he signed it. Because he hadn't. He just started. And now he signed it after he's received his consideration, and Mr. Hicks is saying there's still no consideration. And I think the commentators say that if you wait a few years until the employee is trained and then have him sign it, that's a better deal than to immediately put a post-employment covenant not to compete on someone who may not only be there for a month or two. You don't know yet with a new employee. This case illustrates what happens if you have no protection. Mr. Martin went out, took five of the salmon systems, 60 systems from Newhouse, Metro, and Vision, which cost CPA revenues of almost $600,000. Now let me ask you this. If Bruce Martin had started in 1980 his own credit protection association, his own debt collection company for the cable system, for the cable industry, would he have been able to take those very good customers, having no experience in the business? I don't think so. And I don't think Mr. Martin would say that. The only reason he could get those customers was because of the goodwill that he generated for the Credit Protection Association. As far as the covenant not being oppressive to Mr. Martin, it was 3 years. And Mr. Hicks says there's no evidence that says that 3 years is reasonable.
I thought we had the best evidence possible. In the record is Mr. Martin's post-employment covenant not to compete that he signed with his new company. And it just happens to restrict him for 3 years. I don't know how much better you can get than by saying that he entered into the same agreement again.
3 years is not an unreasonable time period. As far as the geographical limit, our limitation is much less restrictive. We've restricted him to 1,200 of our accounts. These accounts are all over the United States. If we had to limit him to geography, he couldn't sell anybody in the United States because that's our market. Here we've only limited him to these accounts. If there happens to be a cable system, multiple system operators, like Warner or Metro or Vision that have offices in the same city, he can go and visit those because if we're not serving one of those systems, he can sell that system that we're not serving. It's not in the 1,200. But he couldn't do that if it was a geographical one. This is a much less restrictive restriction. There's a case out of the Dallas Court of Appeals that was decided recently, Travel Masters versus Star Tours, that had no geographical limit also, and the Court of Appeals there found it to be reasonable. The Utah Supreme Court in Systems Concept versus Dixon, which is a case I think you all should read because it's incredibly similar to our facts here. You have a cable television equipment manufacturer who has a national sales manager that they train, and she started out as a person inside and went on up the ladder like Mr. Martin did. And they had her sign a covenant not to compete, and she quit and went to work for a competitor, and they sued, and the Utah Supreme Court found that there was consideration by continued employment. They found that there was no geographical limitation because, again, it's a nationwide business. And they found that was all right. They found that there was goodwill created by this employee and it belonged to the employer. And I think that's an important issue here. Granted, Mr. Martin probably does have his own personal goodwill. But when he was at those trade shows, when he was selling for Credit Protection Association, he was not selling Bruce Martin. He was selling Credit Protection Association. If he was selling Bruce Martin, he was breaching his fiduciary duty to his employer. If in the last 3 months he's telling everybody, and there's no evidence in the record about this at all, this is just hypothetical, if he was out there saying, I can do this myself, I'm going to set up my new company, I don't think this court would have any problem in restricting his activities. He wasn't out there selling Bruce Martin. And that's completely different than Joel Hill, who paid Mobile Auto Trim for the franchise, paid him a percentage of his revenues every month. And he was the one who went in and had the automobile dealer relied on him for his expertise. The cable companies who employed Credit Protection Association didn't rely on Bruce Martin's expertise in going out and collecting their bad accounts. They relied on Credit Protection Association. Credit Protection Association is the one who sent out the letters and contacted the people who hadn't paid their bills. It was not Bruce Martin. Bruce Martin solicited accounts for Credit Protection Association. He wasn't going out door-to-door collecting the accounts that they got. Getting back to Systems Concept, they also found that the employee had special and unique and extraordinary services to the employer because of her position as a national sales manager. And that's essentially what you have here. You have Bruce Martin, who's the vice president in charge of sales, national sales manager, the title doesn't matter, going to this company, quitting in 1 week, setting up a new company, taking one of our best employees, one of our best customers, soliciting our customers, and going along his merry way. And that is something he could not have done unless he had worked for Credit Protection Association. And it was something that Credit Protection Association had the right to protect. There's no injury to the public in this case because there are some 7,000 cable systems in the United States. We've restricted him to 1,200. And they are probably the 1,200 best and most profitable. But that is what CEA business did for them during the time period that they built it up from 1977 through 1985 when Mr. Martin quit. In fact, in the record, Mr. Levine, the owner of CPA, testified that when he started the business in 77, he tried to get Bruce Martin to come with him then. And Bruce said, no, you can't make any money doing that. 3 years later, he finally got him hired. 5 years after that, he quits and starts his own company doing the same thing with the knowledge that he's gained from Credit Protection Association. I think if the court reviews the record in this case, that you'll find that this covenant meets all of the requirements of Hill versus Mobile Eye Trim. There was valuable consideration given. It's reasonable at the time, territory, and activity. And there is a legitimate interest of credit protection association that needs to be protected. It's business goodwill. If a company can't do that, it will restrict the ability to train their employees. They won't train their employees. It'll be an economic disincentive to have a national sales manager, which is economically efficient for this company and for all other companies. If there aren't any other questions, I'll conclude my argument.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you. I intend to be very brief. With respect to the burden of proof issue, I quickly looked at the Hill case during counsel's presentation, and I find nothing specifically addressing that. I am correct that the Martin versus Women's Service case does place the burden squarely on the employer, although I was wrong. There is no writ in that case. Here, the employer was the plaintiff, and I think our law is, if we have nothing else here, that the plaintiff has the burden of proof in a case such as this, and that's in particular true, I think, where here in Hill and in other cases, there is no presumption that a restriction is valid. So someone has to have the burden of proving that a restriction is valid or what restriction is valid.
Well, his burden is to prove that the restriction exists, and he did that by introducing the contract. Wouldn't the burden then shift on you to show that it was an unreasonable burden?
I don't
think so. A restriction on competition, it seems logical to me that whoever seeks to prove something, either affirmatively or defensively, would have the burden of proof on that.
I agree with you that he carried his burden of proving the existence of the covenant. But the law is there is no presumption that that covenant is valid. So doesn't the person who introduces it have
no presumption that it's invalid either? If he introduces the covenant and it's got everybody's signature on it, why wouldn't that constitute prima facie evidence that there is a contract?
If someone wants to avoid that contract or vitiate that contract, it seems to me logical the burden of proof would be on the one who attacks the contract. Well, I think what I'm trying to say is there's no presumption, contrary to other contract issues, there's no presumption that any covenant contained in the contract is valid. Now then someone has to prove, not that it's invalid, because there's no presumption that it's valid. They've got to prove that what they wrote is valid. And I think that's particularly ought to be the case here, where you start out from the proposition that these kinds of contracts are against the public policy. Start with that, ab initio, that's where you start.
They went out with indentured servitude, didn't they?
I didn't hear you say, went out with indentured servitude, didn't they? They did, and I hope that remains the law in the state. Where there's no, and this is contrary to your right, as to general contract notions, where there's no presumption that the contract is valid, the burden of proof ought to rest squarely on the employer to prove the validity and legitimacy of restrictions which are otherwise contrary to our public policy. I would also note that there's no cross point of error here, that the burden was misplaced in this case. That is where it would normally rest on the plaintiff. There is also, and this going back to the consideration question which was addressed to counsel, was there any training or anything received after the covenant was signed? The answer is there is no evidence that any further consideration was received by Mr. Martin. Indeed, an examination of the covenant itself states what the consideration was intended by the parties to be, and that was simply he got to keep his job. The counsel has discussed goodwill extensively and has tried to distinguish between that which might have been Mr. Martin's personal goodwill vis-a-vis what was the business goodwill of CPA. Unfortunately, there's no record evidence upon which to make that distinction. There isn't even evidence here that goodwill exists, and there's certainly no record evidence as to the strength or existence of Mr. Martin's personal goodwill or the strength or existence or protectability of CPA's goodwill. And to argue here on that record that this is somebody's goodwill and this over here is someone else's goodwill is not in this record and is contrary to common sense, because the ability to deal with customers, to be successful with customers, seems obviously to me to have elements of both personal goodwill and business goodwill. You can have a good business, but if you've got an idiot for a salesman, he can't sell anything. If you've got the greatest salesman in the world, but you've got a lousy product, you still can't sell it. You've got to have both. And there's no record here to distinguish, as counsel was trying to do, between which was the basis for the protectable interest and which wasn't. CPA, incidentally, controlled 40% of the market at the time this case started. I think a position which General Motors would envy. That's quite remarkable. And I think the record also will reveal that there was no one even close to him. This was the preeminent company in the industry and had been so for some time. Thank you very much.
Thank you,
Kim. Well, we'll take a short recess.